I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Mental health resources in Kansas these days are thin. That's leading to a dilemma for people who don't need to be institutionalized, but also aren't quite ready to live independently. The result is those folks end up in a sort of limbo. Today, a conversation about how a lack of resources and affordable housing can keep some mentally ill stuck in nursing homes. Then, the film critics return. They've already seen the movies and they're here to review them, so you don't have to guess if it's worth your time and money. There's new releases featuring Octavia Spencer, and we'll learn about a new one from the woman behind The Babadook. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. A scathing new report in Kansas concludes that nursing homes for the state's mentally ill are falling way short. Those homes are warehousing people rather than giving them the skills they need to live independent lives outside the homes. The report from the Disability Rights Center of Kansas argues that more of the nursing home residents could be living at home while taking advantage of community-based services. The response from state officials has been there's definitely room for improvement, but there's also a need for a significant overhaul of the state's mental health system. With us to talk about this new report, Rocky Nichols is executive director of the Disability Rights Center of Kansas and a former state lawmaker. Rocky, nice to have you. Good morning.
Great to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Cindy Luxem is president and CEO of the Kansas Healthcare Association. Cindy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
I should point out they're joining us this morning from Kansas, the Kansas News Service over in Topeka. Rocky Nichols, I gather you've sensed concerns with these nursing homes for the mentally ill for some time now. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, the term warehouse is not a term that we chose. We hear that from our clients. Mm-hmm. That's how they describe these places. And I think to really understand where we're at, we have to spend just a moment, Steve, talking a little bit about the history of this problem. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem of these nursing facility for mental health institutions, people winding up in them, getting stuck, and not being able to get out. It's a long overdue problem that needs a solution. And really, we're in a mental health crisis, particularly for the over 600 people who are in these facilities. The problem is really that NFMH is, unfortunately, for too many Kansans, act like a black hole.
And where, and use an acronym there I'm not familiar with.
Oh, Nursing Facilities for Mental Health.
Gotcha.
Oh, yeah. So if we slip into acronymville, if we say NFMH, we're talking about Nursing Facility for Mental Health Institutions. My apologies. But they act like, for too many Kansans, a black hole where people end up, they languish, they get stuck, and too many of them can't get out. And really, it's plagued Kansas for decades, and I'm living proof. So take me. Nearly 30 years ago, I started my public service career, which is the intersection of public policy and mental health issues. Started in 1991 as an aide in the legislature, was elected in 1992. And we were talking about this issue back then in the early 90s, how people get stuck in these facilities and they can't get out. During my tenure in the Kansas legislature, again, I started in 91. It continued. So fast forward from 91, 10 years, 2001, I was a ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee. We put a proviso in the budget, which is essentially a rider that requires the legislature to do something. It required the required the state agencies to do a study of these nursing facilities for mental health. That study found that people go into these NFMHs, they get stuck, they have difficulty getting out. Again, this is 2001.
And here we are 20 years later.
Exactly. 20 years later, the picture that study painted was bleak. But really, nothing has changed. So in 2001, that study found there were a handful of nursing facilities for mental health institutions, 13. The bed capacity was around 700. Fast forward 18 years, there's a handful of nursing facility for mental health institutions, 10. And the bed capacity is still around 600 to 700. There's been no meaningful change.
Right.
And so the legislature.
Hang on a second, Rocky. Let me just get Cindy to hop in here for a moment. And maybe we should.
I thought it was a Rocky and Steve show.
Well, yeah. Maybe we should slow down just for a minute here, Cindy, and talk about this concept of nursing homes for the mentally ill. This might be an idea that confuses some people. What are these places, Cindy?
Well, so let us talk about history for a moment. You know, back in the day, Topeka was very well known for its fabulous mental health services when the Menninger company was here and family and doing what they did. And then someone got the idea that we should get rid of all the state hospitals and do some reorganizing of that particular thing. The Menningers ended up moving out of the state. And at that point, believe it or not, I believe, you know, somewhat of the nursing facilities for mental health actually came out of the mental health world, because I understand that one of the Dr. Menningers had some influence on that decision. So, yeah, they've been around a while. And Rocky talks about history. When I was working in the Senate Minority Leader's Office in the year 2000 moving forward, that is when provisos were put in, and also the money follows the person issue came about. And we had a state program for many years up until actually just a few years ago where they discontinued that, where people had the financial services to transition out of those communities back into another community. You know, the situation is that when the nursing facilities for mental health, they do exist. You can call any one of them today if you needed help for your loved one. None of them have any openings. They are maxed to capacity. Hmm. We have asked for years to look at the topic, to say people, you know, maybe a different type of licensure category needs to be. These are often viewed as group homes, and they're not group homes. They are considered nursing facilities by the federal government. So they fall under all of the same rules and regulations for quality and
right.
But they don't get paid the same because they're considered institutes of mental disease, and so they're not the states are not supposed to use federal Medicaid dollars to help support those individuals. So,
So to Rocky's point, do you share this concern that some residents of these homes are being, in fact, to use the word that others have used, warehoused?
No, I do not go along with that word. Because the thing is, anytime anyone is admitted into a nursing facility, they are supposed to have a discharge plan. They are supposed to have a plan for exit.
But apparently that's not happening based on what this report concludes.
You know, the report focused on a few particular areas. And, you know, as I'm talking to my providers, I know what what kind of programming my providers do. I know I have been out there. I know what kind of community interactions they have in trying to get their residents acclimated back into a normal lifestyle. I also understand that oftentimes this is the safest place for some of these individuals.
I get that, Cindy. Yeah. Let me just cut you off again. I mean, Stephen Caranda from the Kansas News Service just did a long story taking a look at this issue, and he began the story by talking about one individual who was living in one of the homes for years, mm-hmm. and a lawyer took up his cause, took
yeah,
a lot of work
to
get him out of that home, and he's doing quite well living independently now. At least that's what the story said. So what about cases like that?
That's fabulous. We need more of those. But the point is that there is a huge intersection of mental health services, community supports, the financing. How does their care get paid for when they moved out into the community? And again, the fact that it is limiting on the amount of dollars, you know, where the dollars can come from to pay for their care.
Right.
It becomes very difficult. And just anecdotally, Steve.
So what you're saying is when folks, if they're released prematurely, a lot of them might flounder because there's no way to support them living out in the community on their own.
They do flounder because, unfortunately, we have also seen the degradation of the mental health centers' funding and those community services. And, you know, not even to mention our insurance companies that are doing CanCare right now. They don't begin to understand how to handle the behavioral health issues. And behavioral health is an issue across the board.
Sure.
In all of our care homes, whether you're talking children or adults or the aged. So we've got a big problem. And, you know, it is fabulous that Rocky's organization have brought this forward again. But, you know, I've been with this association for 16 years. I was working in the legislature. I wasn't, you know, elected like Rocky was. But this has been a topic around for a long time, so maybe right. this will finally be the impetus to get some changes. And, you know, we've all beat right. our heads against the wall to try to do some different things.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about a scathing new report out of Kansas that concludes nursing homes for the state's mentally ill are falling way short, warehousing residents for far longer than they should, but some objections have been raised to that report. Rocky Nichols, what about this concern that Cindy just raised here, this idea that, you know, they're staying in these homes, but if they're released too soon, they can't do very well on their own outside in the community because there isn't much of a support system there to help them out.
Well, this argument of there's no place to go argument is really a false argument. It's a classic which came first, chicken or the egg argument. And I can say definitively that the no place to go argument is not correct. Here's the facts. The state is spending state general fund dollars that can't be matched, $20 million a year, to house roughly 630 Kansans in NFMH institutions.
Right.
So hypothetically, if the state got to a point at some point in the future where one day we did not have to spend that $20 million on nursing facilities for mental health, those dollars can be invested and targeted in mental health services that receive Medicaid match, which these institutions cannot by law, that would leverage an additional $30 million.
Okay, Rocky, are you saying that you want to get rid of these?
So you have a total of $20 million.
Do you want to get rid of these nursing homes altogether? Is that what you're suggesting?
No. I'm not saying you get rid of them all, but I'm saying for every dollar you can save from nursing facility beds, we argue in our report that you ought to be downsizing and right-sizing. And for every dollar you can move into the community, that is then matched with $1.50 of federal funds. So you suddenly have $2.50 that you can spend on that individual to get them services. And instead of spending nearly an average of $50,000 per resident per year in an institutional setting, you can be providing services where the federal government's kicking in and you can provide better services in the community.
Well, Rocky Nichols, you have a Democratic administration in Topeka right now with Governor Laura Kelly. How open is this administration to the idea you're throwing out here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that they're very open to it. Already had some discussions with them. We think that there's great hope in that regard. But as we talk about this policy, I want to make sure we hone in on the key finding of our report. And that is that regardless of whether you think that deinstitutionalization should have happened faster or slower, or regardless of that debate, the fact is that too many Kansans are being unnecessarily institutionalized in these facilities. And the U.S. Supreme Court in the Olmstead decision, which, by the way, was decided over 20 years ago,
right,
said that unnecessary institutionalization is discrimination, and it's not allowed under the ADA. So
let me just get Cindy back into the conversation here, Rocky. Cindy,
sure.
You're not buying that contention, at least the way Rocky's throwing it out. Do I understand correctly?
Well, let's just understand what's going on here. You know, I work with the membership of my association, of which the majority of the nursing facilities for mental health are in our association.
Right.
And Rocky works for an organization that is a disability rights group. We have been at odds on many occasions about topics. The situation is that, you know, the way I look at it is that we all know that a problem exists. There has been downsizing. Like Rocky said, there used to be 13 to 14 of these homes, and there's only 10 now. And quite honestly, I'm not sure even if those 10 will still be around in the next couple of years because there's a lot of changes. So, yeah, we do need to it. But the behavioral topic, whether we're talking about these folks living here or people in community, this has been mental health is something everybody has ignored. So let's get with the program
right.
and stop ignoring it and try to do something about it and figure out what is going to happen.
But this concern, Rocky Nichols, that some Kansans have been, again, quote, institutionalized in these homes unnecessarily for so long, you pointed out early in the conversation, this problem's been going on for 20 or 30 years. My question is why? Why hasn't the state stepped in?
First of all, I don't believe that they are there unwillingly. Oftentimes, these are the safest communities and the safest environment for these people to be living in, not only for that individual, but sometimes the community. Some of these homes have a large inmate population of people that have been in prison for some reason.
Right.
And they're now living in the community. And so there is some real serious discussions to be had actually about some of these folks living in these nursing facilities for mental health before we can say, yeah, let's just release them into the community, because guess what? The community is not prepared.
Steve, can we talk about a real-life example that I think will illustrate this?
Answer my question. Why is this going on as long as it has, Rocky?
Well, I think Cindy's answer helped encapsulate it, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to call you out a little bit on Cindy on using the term these people. I think that's the problem, that people refer to people with lived experiences and mental health people as these people or those people. I used to serve on a national board where the person with significant mental illness would show up to every board meeting with a shirt that said, I'm one of those people. And then in 1999, the U.S. Surgeon General made a groundbreaking report. And one of the things they said is the culture has to change. Here's a direct quote from that report. Stigmatization of mental illness is an excuse for inaction and discrimination that is inexcusably outmodeled. That's from 1999. The U.S. Surgeon General is saying that that happens.
Right.
These places are outmodeled. And the Dennis Ritchie example from KCUR is a perfect example. He wound up in one of these places. He had a little rough patch, but he thought he was going to be there a couple of months. He languished there for 6 years. He tried to get out. The system was not set up to get him out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only by happenstance, only by the fact that he volunteered to an animal shelter that one of our attorneys, Kip Elliott, worked at, is why he ended up getting out of there. And believe you me, it was very difficult, even for one of our licensed attorney who knows the ropes, to be able to get Dennis out. And he's thriving. There are far too many examples like that.
Right. My question now, Cindy, let's turn to the idea of the path forward here. The problem's been lingering for decades. What's going to happen this next legislative session? What are the next steps that are needed here?
Well, I'm kind of afraid to open my mouth. There are work groups happening right now. Rocky is leading several of those. So in our association, and the providers are a part of that. We just have to keep talking. You know, it's kind of funny, but yeah, there's been almost a report every year since 2001 about this topic. And I guess we do need to look at the powers to be and those government folks and say, what do you really care about as far as governing? We have some real serious issues in our healthcare network in Kansas, and mental health is a definite part of that.
And Cindy, I think it's fair to say we have some really serious issues when it comes to mental health treatment in Kansas, don't we?
Sure. Yes, we do.
I mean, the problem has been ignored, all kinds of issues from the hospitals right down to the community health centers. I mean, it's so difficult to access the system, and folks out there flounder around for weeks trying to figure out how to help a loved one out.
And I know no one really cares about it, but our providers on an average in those nursing facilities for mental health, because of how the rate structure, they get about $100 a day. Many of us pay more than that for child care and animal care, and they are expected to do $100 a day, 24/7 care.
Right.
So let's think about that. Anyway, there's some serious problems, and we are glad that the report has come forward. It brought a lot of attention to it. So all I can say is that we hope to be a part of the solution.
You know, Rocky, this is a complex system, mental health, in any state. And I'm wondering about the capacity of a part-time legislature to tackle it and come up with improvements. I mean, you used to be a member of the Kansas House. What about that?
Well, I tell you, if I sound passionate, if I sound purposeful, if I sound a little upset, it's because I'm all those things. Partially because this issue has vexed me personally and professionally for nearly 30 years. It's something that I'm passionate about because I've been waiting and wanting the system to change for so long. and it hasn't changed. And, you know, our report, which, by the way, I have to say, we have a team at the Disability Rights Center of Kansas who worked on this report. I came in at the very tail end. It's really the staff report. They did an awesome job putting together this report, researching it.
What about the legislature's ability to recalibrate mental health?
Yeah, I mean, I think the legislature, particularly this governor, clearly have that capacity. But it's going to take focus. There was a report issued in 2002. It had many of the same findings. There have been other reports. There just hasn't been the political will. But hopefully this hard data will change things. The fact that our people interviewed nearly half of the residents and 70% of them said they want discharge back into the community,
right.
But only 9% said that they had a discharge plan. That shows, that real data shows that this is a real meaningful problem, and it demands action by this legislature and by this governor.
Well, we'll
and
watch.
I'm hopeful that that will happen.
We'll be watching closely this next session and to Governor Laura Kelly's remarks about this going forward. That was the voice of Rocky Nichols of the Disability Rights Center of Kansas. Cindy Luxem also joined us. She's president and CEO of the Kansas Healthcare Association. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
After a short break, we're going to come back and talk to you about the best independent films to go out and spend some time with this weekend. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I am Steve Kraske. Do you believe in magic? Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up for my weekly newsletter. And just like magic, exclusive insights from me will appear in your inbox every Monday afternoon. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Monday on the show, we sit on the banks of the Missouri River, so it makes sense that Kansas City has a port authority, but you might not realize just how powerful it is. We'll meet the leader of the agency and ask him who he answers to. Well, remember Mike Wallace, the hard-bitten CBS News investigator who made his name through memorable, confrontational interviews? Well, he's back in the form of a new documentary that looks back on how he did what he did. Our critics wonder whether Wallace deserves a film that runs an hour and a half. Another documentary making the rounds right now is titled Maiden, and it's an adventure tale that looks at a dozen young women who back in the late 1980s took part in a round-the-world yacht race and, surprise, surprise, did pretty darn well. Our film critics are here to run down these films and a whole bunch more. They are Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Steve Walker's here.
Hello.
Steven.
Nice to see you.
And Bob Butler, whose reviews you can read at butlercinemascene.com.
Good morning.
Hi, Robert. Let's start with some news from the Glenwood Arts Theater out on 95th Street in Overland Park. This week, they announced some interesting showings coming up. Cindy, what do we know about that?
Well, they're doing the National Theater Live.
Yeah.
Plays, productions of the plays in high def. I saw you at one when
yes.
they were over at the Tivoli.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are amazing. And if you've never done one, they're bringing back some of their best, like Danny Boyle's Frankenstein, like The Audience with Helen Mirren playing Queen Elizabeth as she met every one of her prime ministers. It's an amazing experience. And I've said it on the show before. It didn't have a home for a while, so Brian over at the Glenwood has brought it on.
That's good for him. And there's the middle of the Map Fest and Music Fest coming up, too.
That is at Screenland. That has become a very legit screening venue for the kinds of films we talk
Where
about.
Where is Screenland?
There's two of them. There's one in the Crossroads called Screenland Tapcade.
Right.
And then that's one screen, and then they have a four-screen multiplex, sort of miniplex. Over on
Armor Boulevard,
yes,
in right, North Kansas City. Yeah,
their festival kicks off on the 28th. 20 movies, everything from dark comedies to documentaries to horror films. One that's intriguing is called Depraved. It's like Frankenstein set in Brooklyn, and they're bringing in some oldies for that festival as well, like Rock and Roll High School, the Ramones movie.
Mm. Okay. Let's turn to some films that are out and showing right now and give our folks some options and things to think about here. Bob Butler, the first one, Hot Air, a right-wing talk show host life is disrupted by his 16-year-old niece.
Well, you'd expect that in this age, a movie about a right-wing talk show host would have some teeth, wouldn't you?
Well, this one's been pretty well defanged. It was directed by Frank Caracci, who actually has a pretty decent comedy background, The Wedding Singer and The Waterboy. Trouble is, this movie, starring Steve Coogan as this bloviating right-winger, has no point of view. Here's the problem. The girl, played by Tess, her name is Tess, she's his niece. Did I mention the girl?
Taylor Russell?
Yeah. Taylor Russell. He finds he has a niece he never knew because his sister is estranged. She's a druggie. Anyway, he takes her in reluctantly, and it takes no genius to see that over the course of time, she's going to mellow this crusty, you know, conservative. There was all sorts of opportunity for political satire here. Alas, the name of Donald Trump is never mentioned, and it ends up being an after-school special because it's all from the point of view of the girl.
The niece is the voice of morality and reason, and every step from that point on, when you realize that, is just incredulous. One scene after another, you just go, really? These are not real people.
And the point being made here is what?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because okay.
It's not funny.
It's not really a comedy. It's not really a drama. Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
We've got a scene here where he has invited her into his radio studio, and then he puts her on the spot.
Hi, folks. Please welcome to the show my niece, Tess. You'll have to excuse her. She's 16 and female. Say hi, Tess. Come on, Tess, this is your big shot. You want an actual debate? This is your chance.
Hi.
Tess would like to offer a tearful defense for these clean slate kids. Tell us, oh young and wise one, why they deserve to be rewarded for breaking the law.
They didn't break the law. Their parents did.
Then they should take it up with their parents, not the federal government.
They are just kids. They've got nowhere to go. Put yourself in their shoes.
I didn't know they had shoes.
That's from Hot Air.
That just turns my
stomach. That pretty well sums it all up.
Given
right there.
The tone of this country right now, that clip just turned my stomach more than the movie did.
Yeah, the wrong tone.
Wrong tone. So Hot Air, three thumbs down, I think, from our critics here. Let's move on to a film titled Loose, a couple attempts to come to terms with the idealized image of their adopted son. Steve?
It's an interesting movie. It's very well acted by such people as Naomi Watts and Tim Roth as the parents of a black teenager that they adopted from Eritrea. Mm-hmm. When he was 10. A war-torn part of Africa. Octavia Spencer plays his history teacher. She is African-American, and she has ideals for her students that verge on stereotyping them based on their gender and their family
background.
Intending
to do just the opposite.
Intending to do the opposite, but she and the son, the boy, who's very well played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., they lock horns a couple times.
Here's the thing. These white parents have tried to do the right thing, and they've raised this kid who is ridiculously perfect. I mean, athlete, valedictorian, blah, 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 blah. Everybody loves him. And then the screenwriters slip in this bad seed. Is he really what they think he is? And in fact, by the end of the movie, you're a little puzzled about just what to make of this kid.
It started as a play. It was written by J.C. Lee. And it did have that feeling of claustrophobia at times. And
there's a Me Too movement theme running through here, too, about some teenagers at a party doing some disgusting things.
Actually, there's a little many. I think maybe too many themes got through.
There's a lot. There's a lot going on. But the performances are quite good.
Yep.
We have a clip here from
We do.
Loops.
This is Naomi Watts as the young man's mother and Octavia Spencer as his teacher confronting each other when she calls her to school.
And I don't know the details of his treatment.
Well, I'm sure you've heard he went through years of recovery and he showed no signs of...
I didn't mean to imply.
I just want to be clear that whatever violence he both suffered and inflicted during that time was dealt with. It's been processed.
Of course. But with the climate around school security the way it is right now, you can understand my concern.
Yes.
Which is why I felt I needed to search his locker.
I'm sorry.
Amy.
He wrote a paper.
A paper in which he describes his belief that the solution to a political problem is to gun down those with whom you disagree.
That's from Loose, Cindy.
I want to mention that it's showing at the AMC 28, only one theater in town, which is surprising, as good as this movie is.
So how many thumbs up do we have for Loose?
I liked it. It's not on my three to see, but
moderate.
I like
moderate.
It.
Okay, Midland Reviews for Loose. Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our film critics about the best indie films showing around town. Here's one that I've heard good things about: The Peanut Butter Falcon. Bob, it's a young man with Down syndrome runs away from his healthcare facility in search of his favorite wrestler, Saltwater Redneck.
This is absolutely charming. It is so charming that while you watch it, you are in a rapture of laughter and tears.
Wow.
Now, when it's all over, you may say, I've been had, but don't worry about it, because during the watching, it is fantastic. You've got this kid. His name is, he's played by Zach Gottsagen, who is a Down syndrome individual, 22-year-old. He's been institutionalized because he's an orphan in an old folks' home. You can imagine what that is like.
Hmm.
He runs away. He hooks up with a swamp rat played by Shia LaBeouf, who is bearded and hairy, and he's on the run because he's half criminal. And basically, they get on a raft and start setting sail for young Zach's goal, which is to join this wrestling school he's heard of. He has created a fictional alter ego called the Peanut Butter Falcon, and he's determined to wrestle professionally.
Jeez.
It's funny. The interplay is great. If you smell a little Huck and Jim here, you've got that going on, too.
I was just
going
to say, yeah.
And then they're joined by Dakota Johnson, is a lady from the home who's trying to track down this young fugitive, and it becomes a holy family escaping to Egypt, basically, from the bad guys. It's a charmer.
It is. It was directed by Tyler Nelson and Michael Schwartz. And Zach Gottsagen, who basically has the lead in the film, carries it well. The casting is fantastic. John Hawkes, who I love everything he's ever been
right.
in, plays Duncan, who's after Shia LaBeouf's character. And you've got Thomas Hayden Church as Clint, the saltwater redneck. Bruce Dern is in it. He plays a guy who sort of a mentor, would
Zach's
you say?
Roommate.
Zach's roommate.
At the senior
That's right.
center, yeah.
yeah. So we do have a clip
yes.
here.
Yeah, this is Jake, or Tyler, the Shia LaBeouf character, and Zach. They're practicing their official handshake. They're on the run during all this.
This is from the Peanut Butter Falcon.
You aren't Tar.
That's right.
Maybe we should. Maybe we should have our own secret handshake.
What kind of secret handshake? For what?
Bud, dude, friend.
Buzz, dude, friend's handshake?
All right, yeah.
Let's go. Hurry up. All right, three of those. Four of those. One of those. No way. Like that.
Yeah.
Only when special happens in life.
Yeah, special thing.
Special things, you don't curse.
No.
Why don't you curse?
I don't.
Okay, come on.
I think the screenplay is just terrific. I really do. And Dakota Johnson, who I never saw any of those Bound and Gag movies she was in. I can't remember the names of them. Oh,
right.
50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
She's so charming.
She's
I really love her.
She's got this great girl next door thing going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, she really
needs
she's
to play
resurrecting
to that.
Her career, perhaps, after
she's good.
Stereotyped early
she's
on.
She's good. Yeah.
So lots of thumbs up for Peanut Butter Falcon. Go
yeah.
see it. We're going to see this at Oscar time, maybe screenplay.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Maybe. It's got that Little Miss Sunshine kind of vibe about outsiders who were headed somewhere to feel better about their lives.
And LaBeouf has gone from being kind of an irritating teen star to a really terrific actor.
He's very good in this one.
It's great. Okay, let's turn to The Nightingale, Steve Walker. This is set in 1825 in Tasmania. It's about a 21-year-old Irish convict seeking revenge for the murder of his family. Wow.
Yeah, it's a
1825 Tasmania. Okay.
It's a wow. It comes from director Jennifer Kent, who did The Babadook, which was a very highly acclaimed
psychological
thriller a couple years ago. And this young woman is horribly mistreated, and her husband. They're both prisoners, although we're never sure what they did.
I think it was theft. They were transported to Down Under, you know. That was what England did with its criminals.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy, the regiment leader who basically has encaptured them, becomes an absolute monster, and he is moved to a different part of Australia. Is that right? New Zealand. I saw it so long ago, Steve.
Oh.
Well, now, in the first 5 minutes, or in the first 10 minutes, we see three rapes and two murders.
Oh, boy.
One of them, a baby. So At that point, you know that you're in for a ride. And basically, the perpetrators of this crime take off across the country, and following them is this young woman and a Aboriginal guide who unwillingly leads her in pursuit of revenge.
Thank you, Bob.
All right. Yeah.
This is a rough movie to watch.
It is.
Oh, this, it is.
It's brutal.
But it's brilliantly done.
There was a major article in the New York Times about the fact that Jennifer Kent is a woman and embraces this violence in this film in a way that people just feel was over the top.
Yeah, no, there's no forgiving.
Did you think it was too much, Cindy?
Oh, yeah. It bothered me tremendously.
There's no forgiving that Jennifer Kent happens to be female with the manner in which the sexual assaults are depicted.
Yeah. You know what? Because she's a woman, I was willing to sit and take it in.
I might not have
if I'd known there was a man behind the camera.
Hmm. I think that's a very salient point, Bob. Yeah.
So this film is respected, but it's tough to watch.
But on the other hand, on another level entirely, it's a really effective adventure movie.
Right.
Traveling across the Tasmania and the jungles and the rivers and the rampaging bad people. It's two hours and 20 minutes.
So it's an epic little film, really.
An epic little film. I like that.
The Aboriginal tracker's role in this is very significant about how Indigenous people are treated. And he did a terrific job. I cannot pronounce his name.
Don't even try.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to a documentary, Mike Wallace is Here. It's obviously a documentary about the legendary broadcast journalist known best for his years on 60 Minutes, Bob.
I have to admit, I really like this. Mike Wallace is the kind of guy you'd watch in kind of a grim, scary fascination, not knowing what he was going to do next. He was a tough guy to do an interview, but this documentary from Avi Belkin suggests the psychological underpinnings of that persona. We see early in his career an acne-scarred young Mike Wallace taking acting roles on TV, early television.
Selling cigarettes.
Selling cigarettes and kitchen supplies and all sorts of stuff. He was your basic soulless pitch man. In the mid-50s, he got a nighttime show on a local TV station called Nightbeat, and he interviewed people, and that set it off. Hmm. Here's the thing. When Mike Wallace went to CBS News, he was distrusted. This was the House of Cronkite, and here was a guy who had started out as an actor, as a pitch man. Come on. And the documentary makes the case that one of the reasons he was such a hard guy was trying to overcome the stigma of all of that.
Interesting.
And in fact, this is something that kills me. The first episode of his Nightline TV show, he says, "We're here to talk to people. I play the role of a journalist."
Wow.
But what's fun about Mike Wallace is...
So he confessed,
This is no different than a 60 Minutes retrospective that they do periodically. But he was equally dogged with the Ayatollah Khomeini, Barbara Streisand, Betty Davis, and Gaddafi.
Vladimir Putin, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of interesting
clips. It was kind of his greatest hits. But I was frustrated because often his subjects weren't identified.
They were pretty famous, though.
I know, but not all of them.
Is Mike Wallace worth 90 minutes, Cindy?
No, it seems to me that it's, if he were alive, this would be his vanity project. Because, again, he worked so hard to be taken seriously and look at the, kind of guests that...
Except that in his last years, he went into a profound depression and thought he was worthless. Which I found to be very telling and touching in a way I had not expected.
Right.
What's the clip we have here from this?
This is a perfect example of the kind of journalism he did. If you listen, he's introducing us to a new celebrity.
There is a new billionaire in town. Trump's the name. Donald Trump is a major deal maker, a swashbuckler. Donald, you're in your late 30s. You got 40 years to live, minimum.
Well, I hope you're right about that.
What are you going to do?
There are a lot of things to do. You know, a fertile imagination and a good fertile mind, Mike, it's really amazing what can be thought of. There are so many things to do.
Politics?
So many. No. not politics.
You've said that you could do a better job at negotiating an arms control agreement with the Soviets than some of these professionals who've been trying to do it for years.
I didn't say me, Mike. I said somebody has to do it. If it were me, that'd be fine. I could do it. Somebody has to help this country. And if they don't, the country and the world are in big trouble.
Well, he got that right.
Yeah, we're in big trouble.
Okay, that's from Mike Wallace is here. We're talking about the best indie films showing in town with our film critics here. Steve Walker, the next film, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? It's a once-accomplished architect rejects her stifling domestic life in an effort to find her bliss.
This is based on a novel that apparently was a huge hit by Maria Semple. I wasn't familiar with the book. But Cate Blanchett's always watchable. She plays this woman who 20 years earlier won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her architecture, which was very innovative. She's married now to a internet czar, CEO, Billy Crudup. And she just decides, this isn't enough. I need something else to do. She raised her daughter, which she's very proud of, and her daughter had her health issues early on. And then she kind of takes off. I think there's a couple scenes in here. We're going to hear a little bit of a clip of one that's one of the best scenes in the movie. She's talking to Lawrence Fishburne, who is another architect who's known her work for a long, long time.
This is from Where'd You Go, Bernadette.
You know, just last night, right? I woke up to pee. You know, I'm half asleep, I'm a blank slate, and then the data starts reloading. It's Bernadette Fox, 20 Mile House, destroyed, failed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like failure's got its teeth in me and it won't stop shaking.
You done?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, because I know you can't honestly believe any of this nonsense.
As much as I like Cate Blanchett, I was very disappointed with this film. I thought she overacted. I thought the way they dealt with a very serious subject about a woman at a certain point in her life, looking forward, thinking, what's next? And I just don't think they accomplished it. Initially, I thought it was going to be some sort of comedy. Kristen Wiig is in it. She plays the next day. She's funny.
She plays her neighbor.
But the rest of the film isn't funny. And Billy Crudup's character is just so dark and bleak and obnoxious.
The first 20 minutes, if you can get through that, I thought the first 20 minutes were dreadful.
Really?
Trying to be cute with a dog named Ice Cream, I was just like, oh, really? If you like Cate Blanchett, you should stick with it.
Okay. Mixed review at best for Where'd You Go, Bernadette. Let's go to a film, Cindy Walker, that's gotten degree of buzz. Maiden. It's a documentary about this exciting adventure of a dozen young women who in the late 80s participated in the Whitbread, the round-the-world yacht race. They were led by 24-year-old Tracy Edwards.
I so enjoyed this movie. It's probably, of the ones that we're talking about, this is my favorite one of this the past month. All the women involved in this attempt to sail around the world have fantastic personalities. It's a lot of fun to watch them. All of this occurred back in the 1980s.
89.
Yeah. And so an effort was made to save the ship, which was rusting someplace. And as a result of that, one thing led to another, and hence we have this documentary. And from what I understand, one of the audiences or the group watching the film gave it a standing ovation.
Wow.
It is just a wonderful story. It's appropriate for anyone, especially young kids.
I would say you should take your nieces, but actually your nephews could probably use it more.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah. No, they're very inspirational young women, and that's what really sells it.
What's the clip we have from Maiden, Cindy?
Tracy Edwards is the captain of the ship, and this is a clip of her making reference to that extra gear.
Knife-edge stuff indeed. In these conditions, one mistake could mean disaster.
One point, we were match racing Rockinor, and we could see her.
We were close to each other all the time. I especially remember along the south shore of Australia where we were downwind, jibing and crossing.
When there is another sale on the horizon of one of your competitors, you will always find an extra gear.
Okay,
and that's and the race took 9 months and was 33,000 nautical miles.
And someone had the foresight to have a camera there through the whole thing, which is thus we get a movie crafted.
There is one marvelous moment.
More than one.
Well, yeah, but one person dismissed them as a tin full of tarts. It was an aluminum boat.
Oh, wow.
They responded by pulling into port wearing swimsuits, just kind of like flipping the bird to all these people.
Oh, wow.
Is it wrong to call these young women scrappy?
No.
Okay, they're scrappy girls for sure.
They are.
Yeah.
And it's about women power.
Women power. And so coming of age in some ways for so many folks. That film, again, Maiden. So as we wrap up here today, anything coming up that you want to point to real quickly? Films coming up down the road, Steve Walker?
I would like to mention that on Netflix, just 2 days ago, premiered the first documentary from Barack and Michelle Obama's Higher Ground production deal with Netflix.
Oh, really?
It's a fabulous documentary.
It's worth watching.
What was it titled?
American Factory.
American Factory.
A look at the Chinese ownership of an American factory and the impact that the relationship among the workers has on the whole city.
It's one of the best documentaries I've seen this year, for sure.
A film, a documentary on David Crosby is coming up, though. Crosby, Stills, and Nash fame. Remember My Name and What a Difficult Personality he all is, all wrapped up in one human being there. How about the three to see, the three films you'd recommend? We post them each week on my Facebook page. Steve, what would you point to?
Oh, I forgot to send them to you this morning.
I'm waiting.
I am putting American Factory on my three to see, because we do want to highlight some streaming options occasionally that are worth seeing.
Okay.
Maiden, The Farewell, and Echo in the Canyon. Those two are showing, I think, at Liberty Hall in Lawrence right now, but in theaters elsewhere. So.
Okay. Bob?
Let's say Peanut Butter, Maiden, and Mike Wallace.
Okay. Wow. That's an interesting set of recommendations. I want to thank our critics, as always, Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler. Thanks for a good conversation. Monday on the show, KC's Port Authority is supposed to promote economic development, but they're catching flack for a history of mission creep. We'll speak with the CEO of the agency that wields a whole lot more power than you might think. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Ron Yerman, Suzanne Hogan, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Yesterday on the program, religious leaders weighed in on Kansas City's gun violence problem. Hear that and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.